Hi, and welcome to the MCB Community Update. My name's Eric Joseph. I'm the Executive Director of the Audible Local Ledger, located in beautiful Mashpee, Massachusetts. It's part of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, MAINE, your main source for accessible community news and information. We bring local news and information to the blind and print disabled across the state. As part of this podcast, we'll interview the Commissioner John Oliveira of the Mass Commission for the Blind quarterly. And in the intervening months, we'll bring experts who have a lot to offer to our community. And we'll listen to what they have to say, we'll ask them some probing questions, and hopefully we'll all learn together. We welcome your feedback and hope you enjoy our series of interviews. And now, without further ado, here is the MCB Community Update. Today, MCB Community Update is excited to speak with MCB's Director of Orientation and Mobility, Allison Bull. We'll dig into Allison's responsibilities at MCB in a moment, but first, Allie, what's your background? Can you tell us just a little bit about your career?
Sure. Good morning. So my career started as an undergraduate at UMass Lowell. I was looking for an internship in the community to fulfill one of my psychology requirements. And I stumbled across Lowell Association for the Blind and began working with them as a volunteer, and quickly thereafter started working with the youth programs and absolutely just fell in love with my job and decided I needed to do this. This needed to be my career. So I worked with Lowell Association for the Blind for a little bit, I would say probably 5 or 6 years. And part of that time I was there, I was also working on my Master's of Education with UMass Boston to become a certified teacher for students with visual impairments and a certified orientation mobility specialist. So I'm actually dual certified. After working with Lowell Association for the Blind, I worked in Lawrence Public Schools as a TVI, which is teacher for students with visual impairments, and an O&M specialist. So I was working directly with students in the school system. And then this opportunity arose, and MCB was always my dream agency to work for. I never thought I'd be here as early as I am, but I'm thrilled to be in this position. I love working with MCB. I've always, in each of my roles, I've always connected with MCB and the employees and staff, and it's always been a wonderful experience. So that's how I ended up at MCB, and I'm thrilled to be here.
That's great. You've done so much. You've really got a very broad, diverse background, but focused in these responsibilities, which is terrific. So let's find out a little bit more about orientation and mobility training and who does the training, how it all works. If you wouldn't mind just taking us through as if we know nothing, tell us what exactly is O&M, as it's called.
Sure. Yeah. So orientation mobility, I'll probably refer to it as O&M. So the orientation piece is understanding where you are in your environment. So whether that's like, you know, if you're in your kitchen, where am I oriented to? Where is my back to the door? Is my back to the fridge? You know, just as a quick example of understanding where you are in your environment. And it can get as broad as understanding where you want to go. If you're on the street walking, you know, what street am I on? What direction am I facing? So that's the orientation piece. And the mobility piece is physically moving around your environment, making sure that you're safe in your environment. So that's usually, for many folks that we work with, is using a cane and teaching cane skills, which is the, you know, the white cane. So that would be detecting obstacles in front of you. It's, the cane is really designed to detect your next footfall so that you're not going to step in a hole or off a curb, or you're really working the cane to miss those obstacles or, you know, walk around them. So that is the mobility piece of O&M. And we have 4 full-time orientation mobility specialists across the state at MCB in different regions of the state. And orientation mobility specialists are, they have to go through a rigorous training. Most of the time, people in this area get their certification from UMass Boston, which is really the biggest program in the Northeast. And it's a master's program. You don't necessarily have to get the degree, but it's a master's certificate. And there's over 350 hours of training to become certified, working directly with people, doing reports and meetings. But there's also a 100-hour praxis course that all of these O&M specialists have to take before they're able to get certified in the field. And that is blindfold training. That's what they call the blindfold class at school. These individuals are put under blindfold for at least 100 hours. You know, we go out into the community and use use the cane. So we're in that experience and we understand what some of the clients might experience as they try to take the bus for the first time to a new location or get on the subway or even just walk to the mailbox for the first time since vision loss. Orientation mobility specialists are the ones out teaching these skills. They'll size somebody for a cane. They'll decide what the best mobility device is. Sometimes that might be a support cane for certain people. And they also can work on some GPS applications or apps that help with orientation mobility on the phone.
Wow. So they have to be highly skilled and trained to be able to do it. You have four of them that work across the entire state. That seems like they must be very busy.
They are highly
highly in demand. Are there plans to try to beef up that portion so that there are more people who can go out? Because I would think that with 20-something thousand persons who are blind, there's quite a need for both orientation and mobility, especially where here on the Cape, Barnstable County is very old in terms of a county age, second oldest in New England. And we are a, unfortunately, target-rich environment for macular degeneration and people who have had vision losing it. So those are the people, I think, who would be most thrown by all of a sudden having to adapt and would need this kind of counseling. So I really hope budget-wise and in every other way, you're provided the resources to be able to amp up that portion of your services, because they sound like they're very, very important. And we're glad you have those four people who are doing it.
I'm grateful too.
Yeah, I bet you are. Does every person who is designated as blind, do they all need O&M training? And perhaps you could tell us a little bit about your part of the registration process. I know that's handled by a different service within MCB, but maybe you could tell us about your part. How do you determine someone needs it or wants it? Do they reach out to you? Do you get notified somehow that there is a newly designated person in this community now, assign one of your four people to go? How's that all work?
So when somebody is registered, depending on where they are in the state, so we have six different regions at MCB. So they will be connected with a social worker that is designated for their needs. So if they are on a, you know, work track, they will be connected with a VR counselor, which is vocational rehab. And if they're not on a work track, they would be SR, which is social rehabilitation. So like a lot of the population you were just mentioning, you know, if they're retired and they're losing their vision from macular degeneration and they're not working, they would likely fall under the SR or social rehabilitation category. So either way, orientation mobility, people are eligible for orientation mobility through either track. So they will be connected with a counselor. The counselor meets with them, does an intake, and determines what services they would need from MCB. So they, every time they meet with a new client, they will bring up orientation mobility, explain what the services are and what's offered through it. Sometimes people decline because I think a lot of the time the cane, they feel stigma with the cane and they're not ready to accept that that might be a useful tool for them just yet. But that doesn't mean that they're not going to be eligible in the future when they decide, you know what, my vision's declining a little bit. I'm just having some trouble. I really would like to have an O&M specialist come out. So it is, as long as they're registered with us, they're always eligible to work with an O&M specialist.
Is there a usual progression, vocational, social rehabilitation, assistive technology, O&M, all of these are different services. Is there a standardized order that they're usually delivered in, or is it really dependent on that social worker's engagement and feedback and analysis of what's needed?
Yeah, it's more the latter. So they're really going to create like an individualized plan for this person. So they might want to use their, you know, maybe they don't really want technology yet. They're not sure. They're like, I've never used a smartphone. That's not really for me, but I would love to go. I always go on walks with my friend in the neighborhood. I'd love to continue doing that. And, you know, it's really important to me that I can still cook a spaghetti dinner on Sunday night. So that would be a rehab teaching goal, right? Cooking, using those skills in the home and orientation and mobilities because they want to go walk with their friend. And this is just a, you know, a random example,
sure.
But they're really taking the person's lifestyle and goals of the person and meeting them where they're at. And because orientation and mobility is a different department than rehab teaching, which would be a different department than assistive technology, we can all sort of work together with the person because we're going out and meeting them at their house in the community. So they can all happen at once, or it can be individualized, like, you know, singularly. Maybe someone just wants to open their case for orientation mobility because they got a new job and they, you know, they're fine with everything else, but they just want to learn the new route to their job. So it can really happen any certain way.
And would something like being able to cook spaghetti, as your example, is that considered social rehabilitation or vocational? Because that would seem like that's a basic that everyone would kind of need a little bit of brush up on or training on.
Yeah, sure. So it could happen for either. SR and VR are really just like umbrellas, really just funding, to be honest with you. Everyone's eligible for the same services. So somebody might be newly blind, but they're still working. So they are under VR, but they want to learn how to use their stove with less vision now, or, you know, laundry or anything like that. So that would be rehab teaching, but everyone still qualifies for that. Similarly to how everyone still qualifies for orientation mobility.
I get it. Makes sense. Some of the tools that you have to work with that people are probably pretty familiar with would be perhaps service animals and, of course, the white cane, which we have a large campaign to try and make drivers more aware that the white cane means someone probably shouldn't be stepping out into traffic, that you probably want to be a little careful. I was at a site law service meeting yesterday where that was brought up as drivers just don't get it. And so we're trying to help with that. But how does a person newly designated as blind receive a cane, get fitted for, like, what's that process? Because I see that as one of the most fundamental pieces of accepting what the change in your life is and what you have to do to adapt to it.
Sure. So that's, again, super individualized. And that's why we have the orientation mobility specialist go out and meet with the person in their setting, in their home or their workplace. And the cane is usually determined based on their travel style. So determining the height of a cane is one piece of it. You know, if somebody's going to use a traditional long white cane, typically we say that it goes up to about their shoulders, but that's not always the case. Sometimes it depends. Well, it always depends on how quickly people walk, their gait, their travel style. If you're a fast walker, you're probably going to want a longer cane because you're approaching these obstacles quicker. If you, you know, maybe walk slower, maybe a shorter cane is more appropriate. It's not really getting in the way. So the orientation mobility specialist will observe the person's travel style and determine the size of the cane based on that. There's different cane tips as well, depending on, you know, the type of travel the person's doing. We have rural parts of the state. We have very urban parts of the state. And, you know, depending on where the person is, they might want like a rolling ball tip on their cane because they're going over a lot of cracks on the sidewalk and it kind of floats over better. Where, you know, if somebody maybe is in a more rural setting, maybe, you know, they kind of walk on the side of the road. It could be they want to walk in their yard and it's a dirt. They might have a different type of tip to accommodate for that. So again, even the cane tip type, very individualized. Some folks use a support cane, and we can't really prescribe a support cane because we're not physical therapists, and there's a lot that goes into that. So we always recommend that they talk with their doctor or physical therapist if they need a support cane, because we want to make sure that the height is determined by that professional. But we can tape a support cane with the red and white reflective tape for identification that somebody is blind or visually impaired, or, you know, we can distribute and kind of work with the person, but that's not really something that they're going to be using in front of them. That's really designed more for people who have some functional vision that will be able to tell if there's a curb or a drop off coming up. But there's also like some folks use rollators, or, you know, in a nursing home, they use other mobility devices. And so we will work with them. If they want it taped, we can tape a rollator. We, you know, it's simple as bringing out red and white reflective tape, taping it appropriately. So the bottom quarter is red, the top quarter is white, to represent that identification, that universal identification, and then, you know, work with them from there. Again, if there's a physical therapist involved and somebody needs more support as they're walking, that's ideal that we can consult with them.
And to be clear, when you say a support cane, that would be a traditional cane that most people would have that would then be taped up with your white and red tape to designate it as a cane. I believe I saw one at the site law service meeting yesterday. Mm-hmm. In fact, a gentleman was using one. And the rollaway, the port, whatever you called it, is the classic senior person with their hands on a walker almost.
Correct.
Which I know they don't like to call it a walker, but that's the traditional name for it. And it could be taped as well and made. So the idea is the white and red is really the trigger for drivers and pedestrians to be respectful of when they're out and about. That's
yes.
really important. Who qualifies for a service animal as opposed to a guide dog, as opposed to simply a cane?
No, that's a great question. Again, super individualized. So it depends on, you know, if the person likes dogs, sometimes they want nothing to do with animals. But we actually get a lot of questions about service animals and dog guides specifically. So really who would be a good candidate for it is somebody who has their own orientation mobility skills. So the foundation of that to be accepted into any school in the country is to have your own independent O&M skills, because the dog is not going to be a GPS for you. The dog, you know, isn't really, you can't say like, okay, walk me to CVS. The dog is not going to know what that means. You can't say, all right, head north on the street. So you really have to still understand your own skills. If the dog is sick one day and you need to use your cane, you need to be able to still go out and be independent. So you're having your own O&M skills is super important. It's as a prerequisite before getting a dog guide. And so folks who do get them typically are very active people. Maybe they're working in the city and they take the subway a lot and they're fast walkers. So it's easier to have a dog there that would sort of pick up on these obstacles. You know, if there's people walking down the sidewalk or on the subway or, you know, whatever it may be. But it's usually for folks that are a little bit more active, because the dog will need to be worked consistently. That was a big issue during the pandemic, when, you know, folks had dogs and they weren't able to get out as much as they were. So dogs were regressing, because dogs are just animals. So they need to work to practice those skills. Like similarly to like if we were tested on geometry information now that we learned in high school, we haven't been practicing it. So how sharp would we really be with those skills? So it's important that the dog is worked consistently, so that they can keep up their skills and still be a reliable service animal. So the person would have to be active. They have to be financially stable so that they can provide food for the dog and vet visits for the dog, because again, it's still a dog. So there's just a few of those different aspects, but I think the most important is that the person has really good O&M skills independently, because I think a lot of the time it's a great, you feel like, okay, awesome, I'm going to get a dog and it's going to fix everything. But the dog is only going to provide a certain amount of support, where it's really, you're still going to be responsible for a lot of the navigation when you're with a dog, if that makes sense.
It does. It does. And even back in high school, I was bad at geometry. But so it would be normal to assume that sort of a prerequisite would be exactly what you said, O&M. And maybe VR, vocational rehabilitation, because there's a good chance they'd be more active and they would be engaged in social events a little bit more, or work events. So those are a couple of prerequisites that when people are considering this, they should probably be thinking, okay, one step at a time, kind of a thing. No pun intended in this case. How long, when you get a cane, I know they fold up. How long do they last? Are they durable? Are they, what do you get out of one?
Well, I think it depends on the person and how they use it. I mean, I know some people that they're out every day using their cane. Sometimes the cord inside snaps. Sometimes it gets stuck in the door of the T. You know, you never know what's going to happen. So I think depending on how you use it and how rough you are with it, or how gentle you are with it, depending on your style of mobility, it kind of ranges. So I would say, for a typical user, probably if you're using it every day, probably it lasts about a year. That's ideal. Maybe 2 years. But I know some people that have had canes for 10 years because they use it lightly. They still have a lot of functional vision, but they'll bring it with them for identification, or, you know, just to new places or something like that. So it really depends on the user. We have different types of canes, like different types of materials. So there's aluminum canes, which are a little bit heavier. We have graphite canes that are a little bit lighter. They look the same, so you'd never know the difference. But when you hold them, you can tell.
Do you provide the canes to people?
We provide the first cane for the person. And then we really encourage folks to just save up a few dollars a week just to be able to have the money to support for a replacement cane when it happens, because it's going to happen. But we do provide replacements if it's needed, and you know, if the person isn't in a financial spot to get their own, because sometimes that happens. But we do like to encourage the person to have a replacement cane already, just as a backup, because you just never know. If your cane breaks, you don't want to be left without anything at all.
Right. No, it makes total sense. I was doing a lot of reading and a little bit of research before we spoke today, and I was surprised to learn how many head strikes. And then when I thought about it, well, now I'm not surprised about it, because it makes total sense that a cane is working the ground and what's directly in front of you, but shelving and cabinets and things that are at head level, other than your home, where you probably have gotten used to them, hopefully through orientation and mobility, would be still pretty problematic, because your cane, you're not waving it around in front of you at a head height. Also understood, and this may be more assistive technology, which we're going to talk about next month, that there is a laser that can be clipped onto a pocket that will give you a haptic or a buzz whenever something is approaching your torso or head. And that will then warn you to either raise your cane or put your hand out or do something. Are you aware of those kind of things? And is there anything that when you're doing your training, other than getting used to someone's own kitchen or room, whatever, that you do to deal with the potential for head strikes, which I hear is quite high and often ends up with someone having to go to the hospital because your head bleeds quite a bit when it's cut, even if it's not a significant injury, it can be very traumatic.
No, absolutely. So the good thing is that ADA does have a requirement that anything, I believe, above 60 inches off the ground, I would have to check. There is definitely a range, but ADA requires it to be cane detectable. So it doesn't mean that it can't be there. It just means that something has to be on the ground to alert the person. So for example, we had this near a T station where there was a air conditioner that came out of the wall at head level. And so somebody who was trying to get to the T, that was a head hazard for them. So the solution for that was putting a permanent planter underneath so that the person felt with their cane and they were able to navigate around it, because that's ADA compliancy. So that's something that's super important. I know a lot of signs on the street sometimes, I mean, they have the pole, but the pole doesn't come out as far as the sign does. So it needs to be over that height. So that hopefully, if there's something that isn't compliant, it needs to be addressed. But other than that, I know what you're talking about. We sometimes use the buzz clip, which is that device that can be clipped on. I have somebody who wanted to walk through the woods, and so she clipped it on a hat, and so that she wasn't hitting like tree branches or anything like that, because that's something that isn't really, you can't really be ADA compliant with trees and nature. But I think a lot of the time that's not preferred, just because of how much feedback it gets. They can be expensive, they can break. And it's hard to, with that learning curve, to realize like, how close is an object? How much is it buzzing? Is it detecting something that's 5 feet away, or is it closer? So there is definitely a learning curve with getting familiar with the technology. There is an upper protective technique that we use and teach in orientation and mobility, which would just be having your hand in front of you, especially in new environments or like if you're hiking, but that can be cumbersome to have your hand out the whole time. So there, you know, there are different solutions for it, but it is something that we identify in, you know, the person's route, or, you know, if that's something that they're at, it's a head hazard, they for some reason are crossing a lot of head hazards on their route or in their environment, that we can help advocate to make sure it's ADA compliant and make sure that the person knows, like sometimes along the street, there's, I know once I pass School Street, there's always that tree branch that comes out over the person's fence. And I know I should put my hand up after I cross, you know, School Street or something like that. So we do work with the person and make sure that they're aware of when there are head hazards, because that is dangerous for anybody. But you're right, the cane really only detects what's on the ground and really up to the waist because of the angle of the cane. But above that, it's not as reliable.
Well, the positive, I guess, take on it, if you're looking for a little bit of a silver lining, if we're looking for that, is that new technology is being developed all the time. And while now it may not be able to distinguish between a tree branch and a shelf or whatever, that there's a good chance in the coming months, years, whatever, that that will be refined. And with much of a lot of assistive technology is being developed to try and help, especially around smart speakers and some of the things that are so critical to changing lifestyles. I really appreciate all the time and the information that you've shared with us, Allie. It's really, really informative. I think it makes a lot of people who might be encountering this in their lives feel like, oh, okay, there's a next step. It isn't just me off in a vacuum and I'm by myself and now I don't have any resources. I have a plan that can be put together, and we are proud to work with you to be able to try and promote that. But at the end of each of our MCB community updates, we have some personal questions. Not really personal, just fun personal questions. So we will close with those questions. Who is your favorite musical artist or group? And what's your first and then your favorite concert?
Oh boy. So anybody that knows me will know this, but my favorite musical group is Green Day, because I'm a 90s baby. So they're like part of my DNA. Big Green Day fan.
I'm an American idiot.
Yeah, so that by far, like, I didn't even have to think about that one. And my first concert that I went to, gosh, I think it was... My dad's a big Beach Boys fan, so I think it was Brian Wilson that I went with the family when he was touring way back. But either that or NSYNC. I'm not sure. It was one of the two.
Say NSYNC. I'm sure that's a lot cooler with a lot of people.
That was definitely, it spoke more to me, but I knew a lot of the Brian Wilson music as well, just, you know, because by proxy, I guess.
And what's your favorite concert of all time? Was it a Green Day concert?
I mean, I've been to so many, it's hard to say. I did see them at the House of Blues in Boston one time. I was so close.
That's so close. Oh my gosh.
I was like, I made eye contact with Billy Joe, you know? So that's definitely one of my favorites. But I used to be a big Warped Tour fan. So that, you know, like when a lot of the bands would come around every summer, that was a big thing. So that was one of my favorite experiences, is to be able to go to the different stages and see a bunch of my favorite artists all in one spot. And it's, you know, it's a whole day made out of it. So
sure. Wearing flannel, I'm sure. Right? At the Warped Tour with those grunge bands. Sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was really hot in the summer, though. So.
Allie, thank you so much for your time and your information. It's been great talking to you, and I look forward to meeting you in person at some point. Thanks so much.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You take care now. Bye.
Bye-bye.